Welcome. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. In his five-part series, Nothing Wild, California's relationship with the animal kingdom is broken. Can it be fixed? Today's guest, Sacramento Bee environment reporter Ryan Sabalo, explores the worsening ecological crisis in Northern California, where invasive grasses are causing fires to explode, fragile habitats are being destroyed, and tens of thousands of water birds are dying from avian botulism. He writes, "It's not an idyllic wilderness up here. In the towns, economies never truly recovered from the collapse of the timber industry. Vacant storefronts and boarded up houses tell the story of what happens when the jobs dry up. Outside tourist towns, government work, farming, and ranching are all that's left. The, quote, wild places, working landscapes where cattle still graze, tractors still rumble, and chainsaws still howl, are not faring much better. These past few decades, an ecological collapse has been underway," end quote. So what will it take to protect biodiversity and wild places in California? Ryan Sabalo covers the environment, general news, and enterprise and investigative stories for McClatchy's Western newspapers. He grew up in Siskiyou County in the shadow of Mount Shasta. Hi, Ryan. Thanks so much for joining us.
Hey, thank you for having me on. I really appreciate it.
Well, it's great to have you on. Let's talk about what really sparked this. You write about what happened in late May, the first time you left your house for an assignment since the COVID lockdowns began, and you were covering a protest in Sacramento, and the first line of your piece is, "A rubber bullet whizzed past my head, just inches from my ear." Tell us about what happened that day.
Well, it was during the George Floyd protests, things got pretty tense. And, you know, there were riot police and there were people smashing storefronts. And, you know, I normally cover environment, but it was kind of an all hands on deck situation. So I got assigned to go cover that for two nights. And it was a rough assignment. I'm not really cut out for that sort of reporting. So yeah, and on top of a rough year, you know, with a pandemic, and we were right in the middle of another dangerous fire season, I needed a break. I needed a break from home confinement. And luckily I have a very understanding wife and kids and bosses who appreciate good environmental journalism. So what I did was I pitched a series of stories that I've been wanting to do for years on the forgotten high deserts of northeastern California, where I grew up. And the stories I ended up doing, I did one on wolves, one on wild horses, one on dying wetlands, and one on sage grouse. And so I spent the better part of about 3 months living out of my duck hunting camp reporting remotely.
And you wrote, I mean, you interviewed such a wide range of people. You wrote, it's a five-part series. These are very lengthy pieces. Overall, I mean, we can talk about this later also, but the experience just going back to where you grew up and really connecting the dots between the history of the state, we're definitely going to talk about this, the climate crisis, and really where we are right now. What was that experience like for you?
Yeah, so when I originally just kind of pitched this as four stories that I really wanted to do for a long time, but there were some common themes that emerged out of all of these. I mean, one of the key things I wanted to get across was it's really difficult to find a piece of California that hasn't been fundamentally altered by humans since the gold rush. Yet, and particularly in cities, you know, there's this romantic notion that if we just leave these places alone, they'll rewild themselves. And I argue that, in particular in this northeastern corner of California, it's so fundamentally changed from all of the development and everything that's gone on that that's pretty impossible. And it's not fair to also cut out the small rural communities that rely on these places for their livelihoods if you just basically throw up your hands and say, well, we'll come back in 200 years and everything will be fine. So how do we split the difference to try to save what's left? That's kind of the key themes in the story.
Right.
So I also explore kind of this concept of saving things to death. That's in, like, me saying that. That's in quotes, right? So every environmental issue that involves any sort of controversy is going to be sued by the varying factions, sometimes multiple times. You know, these varying groups have often very good intentions, but what it does is it leads to very little innovation on public land for managers to try to act quickly to try to save species and habitats. And because agencies are basically in this, I don't know, lawsuit prevention mode. So you end up with this kind of a bureaucratic vapor lock where it becomes extremely difficult to move quickly to save things. And then we talk a little bit about how when the various factions actually come together at times to try to split the difference and help people living in these places and save the environment, the hardliners on the edges of these issues are so influential and they have political allies that they're able to come in and kill these things before progress is made. And so you have kind of like this stagnation while problems build up, if that makes sense.
It does. And I think this is so incredibly important. In your piece, you write in one of your pieces, state and federal regulators and scientists are largely paralyzed to do anything about this, thanks to a constantly growing array of regulatory demands that suck up their budgets and staff time. There's very little innovation in the public's land and wildlife management these days. And as you say, the threat of lawsuits from competing interest groups makes restoring even a few acres of habitat a years-long process of expensive studies, planning, and lawyering.
Yeah, I mean, and this isn't something that's in the story, but as I've reported on before, is, you know, on that theme, you know, one of the things that they need to do in California is restore fire, safe fire, right, to our landscapes through things that are called prescribed burns. And it can take up to 10 years to do a prescribed burn through all the planning and budgeting and all the things that they have to do. And we're talking for like a couple hundred acres, right? Now imagine that spread out over, you know, hundreds and hundreds of thousands of square miles across California. And I think you can kind of get a sense of what I'm getting at with that sort of stuff.
What would it take? Because we've done so many shows, obviously, about fires. Given all the interviews that you did with a variety of people, what would it take to actually change that?
That's a good question. it's going to require hardliners, I think, to be willing to take risks, right? And that's one of the challenges with a lot of this stuff is you're going to have to back away from some of your hard-fought ideals, the things that you put on your mission statement for your environmental website or your property rights group's mission statement. And that's a very difficult thing to do when that's how you collect your funding. You've got idealists working in there. And I'm not sure that that is something that can actually happen in today's kind of politicized and polarized environment.
Well, and so you grew up in Siskiyou County, and, you know, for those who are not familiar with the area, Siskiyou County is almost 5 hours north of San Francisco, right before you hit the Oregon border. Just give us a sense of what the place is like politically. What do we need to know about Siskiyou County in general?
Well, so this story, Siskiyou County plays a role in the story, but there's a part of California that's about the size of West Virginia that nobody lives in. Right? there are a few hundred thousand people there. Cows vastly outnumber people up there. It's usually, you think of, some people may have gone up and visited and seen Mount Shasta and Mount Lassen. But there's also another volcano up there called the Medicine Lake Volcano. And they're all this little three volcanic area, this three volcano area, a lot of sagebrush, a lot of high deserts. It's very cold in the winter. It gets down, below zero at times. And in the summers, it's, you know, hot, just like the rest of California. And I love this place because I grew up there, but I also, I enjoy kind of the get off my lawn, the rest of California mentality that folks have up there. This is where the heart of the state of Jefferson secession movement is. And it's part of the, it's the Western, the most Western part of the American West. How's that? Does that, if that makes sense? There's cowboys and, it's just a, it, I love it up there. And that's why where I go, I am not a city person in any way. And when I want to go recharge my batteries, that's where I go.
Let's talk about the Native history. You write quite a lot about the Native history. You write that the entire region was once a body of water that stretched from the California border into Oregon over 1,000 square miles. As the Ice Age ended, the lake drained off to become three primary lakes, Upper Klamath, Tule, and Lower Klamath. Giant marshes connected to rivers and springs that swelled and contracted with the seasons through droughts and floods. And you interviewed Don Gentry, chair of the Klamath tribes. This is a federally recognized nation made up of the Klamath and Modoc band of Northern Paiute Indians. And he said the Klamath name, is it Uskanini? Means people of the lake?
I'm not even going to try it because I'll mangle it so badly. Yeah, but that is the name of, in their language, the people of the lake. And they survived and thrived up there for eons, hunting waterfowl in these massive seasonal wetlands. They caught salmon and sucker that live in the wetlands and that would swim up from the tributaries. Downstream, you have along the Klamath River, three distinct tribes with their own language families. And you've got the Yurok, the Karuk, and the Hoopa Valley tribes. This amazing river that ran through this entire ecosystem. And what's interesting about all of that is, and the focus of the story was how early last century, basically, homesteaders came in, the federal government drained those wetlands, power companies came in and put dams on that river and fundamentally changed that entire ecosystem. So where once were these giant wetlands is now you have farmland and you have a few wildlife refuges that serve as surrogate wetlands for what that used to be. And it's all, the entire system now is managed through canals and turns of a head gate. Like if you want to flood one of these wetlands, at least Lower Klamath and Tule Lake up there on the Oregon border, it requires water coming and basically through a farm ditch. And what's ended up happening is as the salmon numbers have collapsed and the sucker fish numbers have collapsed, the Lower Klamath in particular in dry years is completely dried up because they're at the bottom of a federal water rights pecking order where they get what's left that from what goes to the fish and then goes to the farms and then what they get the leavings from what's left. And that story on my wetland story focuses on what's happening in the summers up there now when you have wetlands go dry.
And you mentioned the dams, as you write, the power company that eventually became known as Pacific Core built large hydroelectric dams, three in California and one in Oregon, blocking migratory fish from their spawning grounds. And then you also write about the Cutchill Act. This is legislation that came out in 1964, which allowed farmers to lease portions of the refuges for growing crops. And you write that to this day, farmers graze cattle and grow wheat, potatoes, and other crops. Migrating geese and ducks gorge on the farmers' leavings. In-N-Out burger fries come from potatoes grown here. You write, go out to dinner at any fancy steakhouse and the beef you eat might have grown fat on a Klamath Basin alfalfa. The garlic and onion seasoning your meal could have been grown in the soil, and the horseradish in the sauce you dip your prime rib almost certainly was. You know, I'm sure a lot of people don't know about this.
Yeah, and that's why I really wanted to have a section in the story that focuses on, you know, we all benefit in some way from the agriculture that goes on up there. And in a lot of these issues, you know, there's a tendency for environmental journalism to focus on heroes and villains. And these stories show, I think, that it's a much more complicated picture. People, you've got these impoverished towns. If you've ever gone to Tule Lake, it is not a thriving metropolis. It's a Tule Lake is the name of this of a town there, along with the waterfowl refuge, if I'm not clear. And I really wanted to highlight for people who don't realize that chances are a piece of your meal, whether you're a vegetarian or not, right, could have come from this these wetlands that have been drained and turned into farmland. Mm. So how do you, you know, come up with a solution that benefits everybody up there? And the irony of this is they actually came up with a solution. A few years ago, the varying factions that had been fighting over fish die-offs and farms going dry, they set aside their differences, they've stopped suing, and they came to the table, they worked together to come up with a compromise that would, the dams would come down, the farmers agreed to give up some of their farmland, the tribes agreed to cede some of their water rights because they have senior water rights up there to the farmers. The wetlands were going to get their guaranteed supply of water every year. And that compromise was killed a few years later by Republicans in Congress who refused to sign off on it because it required some funding from the federal government because of the dam removal issue. To the Republican congressman, it's we can't take down what Congressman McClintock once said, perfectly good dams when we're running out of power during the middle of our summers. And so we're right back to where we were. And in this case, what's going on now is when the refuges are going dry in the summers, it exposes a lot of this naturally occurring botulism mud up there. And if there's not enough water to spread the ducks out, what you end up getting is ducks that are either first coming down in their migration or their resident ducks and shorebirds, and they're catching botulism by the thousands up there. And it's a really miserable way for these birds to die. I spent 2 days on airboats out there with the federal biologists collecting maggoty duck carcasses. This year was by far the worst on record. They either rescued paralyzed ducks or picked up the carcasses of tens of thousands of them this year. And it was one of those things that was really, really sad to see. And especially since those refuges have played such an important part of my life. I'm a duck hunter. I grew up there going duck hunting with my family. And to see these places that were once the gem of the Pacific Flyway basically go dry. This year, Lower Klamath during the fall migration didn't receive a single drop of irrigation water. Mm. It's just a terrible, terrible situation to see.
Yeah, this was just so sad. I mean, the first line of that piece is, even through my face mask, I could smell botulism and decay as the mallard baked under the midday sun. The duck floated on its back near a patch of tules. It was writhing with maggots. What does this smell like?
So it's not decay. It's not like when you smell a mouse in your wall that had died, right? It's like a higher pitch smell, for lack of a better word. It's sickly sweet. There's a distinct smell. The biologist warned me about it. It is a distinct smell that botulism toxin gives off as it, or something. I don't know, but you get it. Luckily, the botulism that's naturally occurring in that soil isn't toxic to humans, but you get this smell all over you after the day out driving through the swamp, splashing all this maggoty water on you, that it gets underneath your fingernails, it gets in your hair. You could smell it for 2 days later if you put your hands up against your nose. It was really... And the thing that killed me about that was you had these federal biologists up there on the airboats doing that, I think, for the better part of 3 months or 2 or 3 months, just every day having maggoty, rotting duck carcasses and shorebirds in your face. And all because we couldn't come up with a solution that could have guaranteed some water to try to spread those ducks out. Mm. And I really wanted to get that across to people. Just the visceral part of that, you know?
So let's go into that a little bit more. The scientists you've interviewed say that it's likely that more than 60,000 birds died miserable deaths. And as you report, these were two of the West Coast's premier waterfowl refuges. All that was left of marshes that were drained for farming during the last century. You write that recognizing its special place, President Teddy Roosevelt made Lower Klamath the nation's first federal waterfowl refuge in 1908. 20 years later, Calvin Coolidge designated over 39,000 acres of Tule Lake as a national wildlife refuge. And just a few decades ago, the refuge drew 7 million birds every year as they made their spring and fall migrations. So talk about just how this happened, that how, you know, how in terms of the water not being available for this area, talk about the politics behind that and how we got to this point.
Well, like I said a little bit ago, the refuges are at the bottom of a water rights pecking order. And so in 2001, they had a big fish kill on the Klamath, or let me back up a second. So in 2001, with a big drought on the way, the federal government shut off water deliveries to farmers in the area, and it caused a big uproar. There were protests. There was a few thousand people showed up for a bucket brigade protest up there. There was even a small little uprising where a group of activists showed up at an irrigation canal and tried to saw off the locks. And the next year, the presidency of the George Bush administration basically reversed course and let the farmers irrigate. And then you had a massive fish kill downriver on the Klamath River. And so in the years since that, what's happened is the tribes have secured greater water rights on the river, which means they get they've been able to pressure the federal government to send more water or keep more water in Upper Klamath Lake, which serves as the kind of the headwaters reservoir to protect the suckers that are endangered in that particular part of the river. Downstream, more water is going to salmon, which to try to prevent those sorts of die-offs. And that's left, the next in line is the farmers. So they get whatever water doesn't go to that. And what's ended up happening is over the last couple of decades, the amount of water that goes to Lower Klamath in particular has progressively been cut off. And a dry year, even on the best year, best water year that we've had recently, Lower Klamath received half the water that it needed to flood its ponds for both migrating, or both for resident birds and for the migration that comes down. And so what you've seen is we used to get 7 million ducks and geese and other birds come through and use Lower Klamath. They're now completely often just bypassing those refuges entirely and flying all the way down to the Sac Valley, where they're basically, you see them in the rice and stuff down here. Right. But so a lot of those birds aren't endangered, but you also have a few endangered species that live around those wetlands up there. And so there is ecological consequences to that. And basically, you've got brush patches where there once was these giant wetlands out there. And it's just, it's heartbreaking.
I think what's so important about the story you tell is if you were to read a headline and maybe not read the article like so many people do these days, you might think that the reason this is happening is because of the climate crisis. And it's so important to know about the history, about the politics, because as you write, these refuges could have had a reliable water supply. As you said, a decade ago, you had tribes, farmers, conservationists hashing out water sharing settlements that would have given the refuges a steady supply of water each year. But Congress killed their efforts. So it's important to talk about the politics. And then, as you write, the drought is a major issue. And the fighting over water will only continue as the watershed grows increasingly dry from climate change. So you really have to factor in all of these elements, right? In addition to the climate crisis. But it's so important to know about the politics going on behind the scenes.
Right. And it's a lot like the fire issue in California. You know, you have... climate change is certainly a part of all of these issues, right? But that also kind of gives cover to just say, well, we can't do anything about it. It's climate change.
Right.
Well, there are things you could do, right, to try to mitigate some of the effects that climate change are causing, right? So I'm glad that you picked up on that, because that's one of the key things I was hoping readers would be able to kind of come across with these stories, is that environmental, like I said earlier, environmental issues, they're so often kind of portrayed as heroes and villains and simple solutions. And these issues are really way more complex than that, than those little kind of sound bites make them out to be, you know? Mm.
Well, we're going to take a quick break. Today, we're joined by Ryan Sabalo. He covers the environment, general news, and enterprise and investigative stories for McClatchy's Western newspapers. He grew up in Siskiyou County in Northern California in the shadow of Mount Shasta, and he wrote a 5-part series for the Sacramento Bee called Nothing Wild: California's Relationship with the Animal Kingdom is Broken. Can it be fixed? And you can find the series at yourcallradio.org. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this.
Hijacked, not by terrorists, but by a president.
This is an attack on democracy. This is an attack on freedom of expression. And this is an attack on European sovereignty.
This week on the Friday News Roundup, a diverted plane, a coup in Samoa, and big oil takes a hit in court and in the boardroom. We'll get to all of it next time on 1A.
Join us for 1A, 11 o'clock this morning on KALW.
In the kitchen, the breakfast stove gave a hissing sigh and ejected from its warm interior 8 pieces of perfectly browned toast, 8 eggs sunny side up, 16 slices of bacon, 2 coffees, and 2 cool glasses of milk.
This week on Selected Shorts, Household Help, Post-Apocalypse.
5 o'clock this coming Sunday afternoon on KALW.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. We are talking about a 5-part series by today's guest, Ryan Sabalo, called Nothing Wild: California's Relationship with the Animal Kingdom is Broken. Can it be fixed? Ryan, I wanted to also ask you, we touched on the salmon, but I wanted to ask you a couple more questions about this. As you write, salmon numbers continue to be unsustainable below the dams that have yet to come down. 3 years ago, the fall run was so small, river tribes could not fish for the salmon. And the tribe's leaders told you at the time that they were bracing for a rash of suicides. Can you tell us more about that?
Yeah, that was really sad. So the way salmon live in, our salmon anyway, live in 3-year life cycles typically. And so what we had during the drought was... you started to feel the effects of having all that, you know, warm oceans and warm rivers. And when the adult salmon were forecasted to come back from the drought years, the run was so low that the tribes who they commercially fish for the salmon and they subsistence fish for the salmon. But you also have to understand that for these tribes, these salmon are so tied to their spiritual identities, their cultural identities, that on the year that they had to close the salmon season, I mean, they were talking about this was a public and mental health crisis in these small rural communities that the tribes live in. And it was pretty heartbreaking at the time. And, you know, I mean, the Klamath Basin just had the, I think it was either the second or third worst hydrological conditions that they've ever had. And so you can probably expect similar closures, you know, 3 years, 3 years down the road. And, you know, this is just, you know, a significant problem for these folks going forward. And, you know, it's going to take however long, you know, they're saying that the next few years, the dams could come down, but there's a bunch of habitat restoration that comes in that. So we're looking at this potentially over the next decade, you know, on top of changing climates and more droughts and, you know, all that sort of stuff.
And we're going to do a show about this, but we just got huge news in the last couple of weeks about the dam coming down. And Native tribes have been working on this for decades. I'm just reading now from a piece out of the Sierra Club. After years of negotiations and agreements, roadblocks, renegotiations, and new agreements, dam removal on the Klamath River is closer than ever to becoming a reality. With almost all the bureaucratic hurdles overcome, four of the six dams on the Klamath are slated to be removed by the year 2024, restoring fish access to the entire river. If it's carried out as planned, this will be the largest dam removal project in the history of the United States, opening up 400 river miles of habitat to salmon, trout, and eels for the first time in decades. And I watched a short documentary about this, Ryan, and it was just amazing to see the young natives who are fighting so hard to get the dam removed so they can hopefully bring back the salmon.
Yeah, it's a remarkable thing. And I would... you know, I'm not a native person, so I would always suggest if you can get some of these folks on the radio, they're fantastic interviews. They have great stories to tell. I would strongly suggest if you guys do that, that you include them in the stories. And one of the other things I think is worth talking, since we're a California paper and you're a California station, we tend to focus on the downstream tribes. You know, they're the ones that will that tend to get most of the ink for us, right? But the tribes in Oregon, the Klamath tribes, I would strongly suggest having those folks on as well, because they're in the upper parts of the watershed, and they're just as excited about having the salmon be able to come back. And the hope is that you know, that they can, I mean, they haven't seen fish. They haven't seen salmon since those dams went in, you know, more than 100 years ago. So that, that's a pretty significant part of the story as well.
Wow. It really is an amazing story. And we're definitely going to have members of the tribe, especially the youth, on the show when we do that. So thank you for that. Let's go to a caller. Let's hear from Miss Hardy in Vallejo. Hi, Miss Hardy. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Hi, how are you?
Okay, thank you.
I think it was just listening to this very, very serious issue. I thought it was wonderful that all these different groups got together and came up with a solution. And I was wondering if all of the Sierra clubs and other environmental agencies could join together to kind of back their solution up and get it passed in Congress, or is it too late to do that?
Thank you.
Yeah, that's a good question. those original agreements took, you know, years of negotiation, and they a lot of those agreements have kind of because the dams are coming down. You know, part of the factions involved in that are getting what they want. The issue is that with the wetland side of things, that's a little bit more complicated because of the water rights laws. And there is opportunities in Congress to try to figure out ways to get water to those refuges. I'm curious to see kind of whether the stories influence folks to try to figure out a way to secure water. There, I've heard some talk that there's talk of doing like maybe you buy water rights from individual farmers that have that are wanting to get out of the business, and you could that would give the wetlands. You could transfer those water rights to the wetlands, and things like that might be a solution as far as that goes.
What do you think will change now that we have Joe Biden as president?
Well, I mean, when we talk about the stories, talk about bureaucratic paralysis, right? And so one of the things that I've been seeing is you have one administration goes in and they immediately redo all of the things that the previous administration did, right? They rescind all the orders, they do all that stuff. And so now we've had multiple administrations going in and rescinding the administration's, you know, executive actions. And I mean, to me, that seems like a recipe for now all the agencies have to go back, replan everything. And it's a years long process to do that. So I hope that, things can be moved along a little quicker to try to save species. But when you're in this constant light of bureaucratic churn, I'm not particularly optimistic of things changing on a dime, if that makes sense.
Hmm. Well, thank you for the question, Ms. Hardy. We have a sort of similar question from Lee, who says, other than Humboldt State University on the coast, there is little to no higher education campuses. Would an investment in a UC campus in the Reading area potentially present a bridge between commercial and environmental interests, perhaps ranching, farming, forestry, as well as a myriad of environmental research could bring people together while injecting much needed investment in the Northern California region?
Yeah, I mean, it could. I mean, one of the things I think that we talk a little bit about bureaucratic paternalism in particularly in the story about wolves, there's a tendency in California to pass rules that affect people who you don't know and you've never met, right? When it comes to environmental issues, any solutions to these problems up there are going to require buy-in from the people on the ground. And I whatever solutions need to happen up there, there needs to be, I think, an effort to really engage those stakeholders in ways that isn't talking above them, right? And so maybe a university could do that, I don't know. But it would be nice to see more efforts to try to bridge gaps, I guess, and to try to mend fences.
Hmm. All right. Well, thank you for that email. We are talking with Ryan Sabalo, who covers the environment, general news, and investigative stories for McClatchy's Western newspapers. He grew up in Siskiyou County in the shadow of Mount Shasta, and he wrote a 5-part series, Nothing Wild, California's Relationship with the Animal Kingdom is Broken. Can it be fixed? And you can find his pieces at yourcallradio.org. Let's talk about the sage grouse, which you write is at risk of disappearing really across the West because of the unrelenting spread of an invasive grass, but also its development, overgrown forests, the warming climate have collided with bureaucratic vapor lock, as we've been talking about. First off, talk to us about this invasive grass and how it is widespread in many parts of California.
Yeah, well, this is the most Western story that I did. Across the West, across hundreds of thousands, or I think hundreds of millions of acres, actually, we've got three different types of grasses that have moved in. These are annual grasses, meaning they come in from seed every year. They're called cheatgrass is one of them. There's another one called Medusa Head, and there's another grass called Ventanata dubia. And these grasses they're from Africa and North Asia, or from Africa, Asia, Europe, and they basically have come in. They've been spread through livestock and machinery. And at this point, they're basically taken over. And what you've got in the sagebrush habitats is you have long perennial grasses are the native species. And they tend to grow in these little clumps. They call them bunch grasses. And you've got the sage, which is basically an old growth forest. Sage has basically, you can have sage that a sagebrush plant that's over 100 years old. And so what happens is you've got this grass spread across the west, and it completely dries out in the summer. Nothing really wants to eat it once it's dry. And so all it takes is a spark, and you get these massive grass fires that burn through these old growth habitats and completely cook the base of the ecosystem. Some of the biggest fires in the west over the last couple of decades have been these grass fires that have torched the sage. And when the sage grows, so do all the dependent species that depend on those that depend on the sagebrush habitat. And I focus on a unique species of a chicken-like bird called the sage grouse. There used to be tens of thousands of them across these sagebrush habitats in California. And I focus on the one sage grouse population, the westernmost in North America, in the Devil's Garden. And just a few years ago, they found five of them out there. They've been trying to keep them alive through transporting replacement birds in from other populations, but it's kind of a losing battle. And they just had two fires that burned in they had one fire last year that burned half the sage on the one side of the refuge where the birds breed. About 20 years ago, another fire burned through the other half. And so you've got this little island of sagebrush, and that's all that's left of these birds' habitat up there. And it was very depressing to see, since these are really cool birds. The sage grouse, it's kind of this iconic species of the American West. They in the frigid high desert winter every year by coming out, and the males do this really elaborate courtship display where they poof out there. They've got these sacks on their chests, and they try to impress the ladies, and they try to intimidate the boys. And it's just it's a really cool thing. And the idea of that disappearing forever was something I've been wanting to write about for years.
Yeah. In fact, if you're on a computer, if you just search an image of a sage grouse, you can see what they look like, and then imagine the courtship happening. That's always just such an incredible thing to see. You write in your story about the sage grouse let me just get the numbers here. Less than 1,900 remain statewide and nationwide. There are between 200,000 and 500,000 in the United States.
Mm-hmm. Yep, and those numbers are substantially lower than what it was before this grass infestation. And there's a bunch of other issues that are contributing to their decline too. But the single most pressing issue when you can lose an entire habitat, right, is this fire. And you can lose it in some cases just a couple of hours, right, because that grass burns so fast and so hot.
Well, right. And as you point out, in the summer of 2019, a motorist tire blowout started a fire miles away from the Clear Lake National Wildlife Refuge on a Modoc County highway. And it roared so incredibly fast.
Yeah, and it's basically cooked their, they gave me special permission to walk through the kind of the closed part of this wildlife refuge just so I could see the breeding grounds. And it was incredible to see just skeleton after skeleton of all of these burned sagebrush plants. And already you would see the Medusa head and the cheatgrass starting to grow up underneath these dead plants. And so one of the challenges with sagebrush is it's so slow growing, and it's really difficult to like replant with farmed stuff. It's really expensive, and it takes a long time to get it to the seedlings to go. And the federal government has, you know, limited funds, and it's difficult for these agencies to be able to get the money to be able to replant. And so yeah, I walk away from that feeling not particularly optimistic. And part of the story also talks about, I'm also not optimistic. There's a new type of herbicide that they can spray to kill off these plants that these invasive grasses that leave the native grasses and the sagebrush alive. So they could start doing some widespread herbicide spraying to try to kill off some of this grass to make fire breaks and to restore habitats and that sort of thing. And, you know, when you start talking about spraying herbicides in the public woods, that is a touchy subject for a lot of the environmental groups. And so, you know, how do you have conversations about the need to spray herbicides to try to save habitats when you say the word herbicide, people start thinking of Roundup and the controversy over that. And so it's a very difficult issue, especially when so much of these woods are public. They're public woods, but they're also being used for things like natural gas extraction, ranching, and all of that sort of stuff, which a lot of times those issues become so contentious that and focus so much of the agency's time that some of this other stuff kind of gets pushed to the side.
The fire that happened in 2019 from that tire blowout, you write that burned the last remaining nesting area for the sage grouse in that part of far northern California. What did scientists tell you about what's to come for the sage grouse? How fast do they reproduce?
I'm not sure how fast they reproduce, but the sagebrush are basically the key to every part of their life cycle. In these high deserts, the sagebrush is where they tend to nest around these bushes as cover. So predators don't get them. They scratch around the dirt looking for bugs. And then in the wintertime, sage grouse have evolved to feed almost exclusively off sagebrush. Which is pretty remarkable since it's kind of I don't know if you've ever smelled, like picked up a handful of sagebrush needles and kind of scrunched it around your hands. It's got a kind of pungent, acidic-y kind of smell. Most animals can't digest it, but the sage grouse can. And it's really interesting. Sage grouse have a special beak that's designed to snip the leaves on sagebrush in just the perfect way so that their digestive enzymes can get into it.
Wow.
And sage grouse, actually, their intestines grow longer during the winter, which allows them to be able to suck every bit of nutrient out of that stuff. And they actually gain weight in the winter, which is pretty crazy. So if you lose the sage, you lose the grouse.
That's amazing. And you also write that before white settlers, the birds were an important food source for the tribes who shared their habitat. The birds also played a key role in their cultural and spiritual lives. Perry Choctoot, a heritage director for the Klamath tribe, said that is where we learned to dance.
Oh, I love that part of the story. I had no idea that a lot of the sagebrush tribes that lived in those high deserts across the West. Perry told me that their dance rituals that they do, if you look, it's very similar to what the sage grouse do. And so the idea that big part of these tribes' cultural and spiritual identities are tied to these birds, I really wanted to highlight that.
I really thank you for doing that. I mean, it should be kind of obvious, but in so many books or stories we get about California, it's like natives are missing. And how can you write about California without including the information that you do? So thank you really for doing that. We're almost out of time. I mean, the series you wrote is really important. What sort of response have you received from readers?
Well, I mean, I find it fascinating that you focused on the two stories that didn't get the most response. I mean, they were well read, but the stories that really got people passionate were about wolves and wild horses. And those stories those issues in general tend to evoke, you know, deep, passionate responses from people. And as you might expect, when I write about a wolf poaching investigation that led to no arrests, folks get kind of fired up. And wild horses are so tied to the romance of the American West that when I write stories that kind of challenge that narrative about wild horses, people who are, you know, very much in love with wild horses might take some issue with that. So that's that's kind of where the most of the responses have been.
Right. Well, if we had another hour, maybe we can definitely have you back to talk about those issues, but five parts, and we wanted to really go in depth.
Oh, I love that you wanted to talk about those, because those are the stories that, those are the two stories that I think kind of meant the most to me personally, because just because I love birds and I love wetlands.
So, yeah, well, thanks. Yeah, they were great pieces. And what are you planning to do from here on these pieces? I mean, what's next? Because you raised so many important questions in this piece, and there's just so much, these pieces, and there's so much work to be done.
Yeah, I'll just, I'm going to keep monitoring the situation up there and keep monitoring the congressional stuff, and there'll always be more stories to tell on these issues.
Ryan Sabalo covers the environment and investigative stories for McClatchy's Western newspapers. He wrote a five-part series for the Sacramento Bee called Nothing Wild, California's Relationship with the Animal Kingdom is Broken. Can it be fixed? Ryan, thank you so much for your great reporting, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. And you can find the pieces at yourcallradio.org. You can also listen to all of our past shows there, and be sure to sign up for our podcast and maybe share it with some friends who don't know about our show. Thanks to Malihe Razazan for producing today's show. Thanks to Kevin Vance for engineering our show and keeping our studio running. Thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.